Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Roberta Verda, and I'm a grateful member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon and Alateen. Oh, thank you so much. I have been so blessed this weekend. I am not a circuit speaker. I don't go around and share my experience, strength, and hope on a regular basis. And to be asked to come to a roundup like this is really just such a miracle that, I was even asked. And then to come and to find a big basket of goodies and cold drinks and juice and a big plant, all kinds of pretty flowers. They're like daisy mums in my room. I mean, I really feel special and so blessed. And I am so, so grateful. And thank you all for having me this weekend. I just didn't decide to come to this roundup this weekend after an invitation. It took me a while to get here. I grew up in northern Minnesota in a medium-sized city, Duluth, if you've ever heard of it. And I was the oldest of three children. I have two younger brothers. And I lived with my mom and my dad and my grandpa. My grandpa was my mother's father. And I knew I wasn't adopted, but right from the very beginning, I had this feeling that I just really didn't belong in my family. They were a little bit different. There was something, and I wasn't sure what it was, and I thought it was all about me. And my grandpa was a really, really old man, really, really old, and he had trouble walking. And he would give me money, and I would go to the corner store and buy beer for him. And he let me keep a penny for some penny candy. And I could get some bubble gum or some little sweet thing and bring my grandpa his beer. And I remember my daddy. My daddy worked and he went out. And sometimes I remember he would be coming home in the morning when I was getting up. And I thought, oh, wow, is that special? Because being a child, I was sent to bed really early, I thought. And to be an adult and to be able to stay up all night long. And he couldn't walk up the stairs. And I really didn't ever know what that was all about. But I knew that my mother was very cranky. And she would make us play outdoors all day long so that we wouldn't disturb my daddy, who was sleeping. In the first grade, I tried so hard to always fit in and to do the right thing. And in the first grade, we had spelling words. And I want you to know, in the first grade, I brought home my book of spelling words at the end of the year. And I had one wrong. I wasn't perfect. I have no idea how many words I spelled correctly in the first grade. But I do remember, I had one wrong. As I went through school, I tried hard to fit in, to belong, to do what was right. The messages at home were always, be quiet, don't say anything, don't ruffle the waters or the feathers of anybody, don't feel. So I tried hard to be a good student. I joined the band. I was on the yearbook. I just tried so hard to fit in. And my two younger brothers were growing up, and I tried so hard to please my folks and take good care of my little brothers. Now, my grandpa, I told you how old he was. As I think back, I think he was probably in his 60s at this time. But you know, when you're that old and you can't walk very good, things are tough and you can't work. And my poor daddy, he was sick. He was sick a lot. And so he couldn't work either. So my mother went to work. And she supported the three children and her father and her husband. And I learned lots of good things about caretaking and doing the right things and just being wonderful. But something was missing. There was something wrong. And I didn't know what it was. Finally, by the time I got to high school, I had figured it out. I didn't have a boyfriend. Now, if I had a boyfriend, then I would be fine. I would be fine. I would fit in. I'd be able to go to the dances. I'd be able to go to the games and just fit in with everybody. And let me tell you, Prince Charming arrived. He was gorgeous. 6'2", a crew cut, Buddy Holly, horn-rimmed glasses, a 1950 green Mercury, just like James Dean. He had all the right equipment. On our very first date, he was such a gentleman. He opened the door, and the town I lived in was on a hill, and the car was parked on a hill, and he opened the door for me to get in. I was so impressed. And out rolled a bunch of beer cans. Some of them were full, some of them were empty, and he just picked them up and threw them in the back seat and made some comment that, oh, that must have been his cousin playing a trick on him. And you know what? At 18, I was not at all upset about beer cans, but I really did see a place for my wonderful organizational skills in his life. If he knew how to keep the beer cans, it wouldn't be such a mess. And we started dating, and it was love. It was. And the neat thing was, I was only a senior in high school, and he was a college man. Well, the next year, I started college also, and he asked me to marry him. Now, I was on a scholarship, being paid, you know, to go to school, and there was just no doubt in my mind. I quit school and went to work to support him so that he could go to school. We're talking 60s at this point, and my daughters hear this today, and they just like, oh, mother, I can't believe, you know, that you would do that. But that's the way I grew up. You know, you had to have a man to take care of you. And let me tell you, I didn't waste any time at all. Most of these girls that went to college, it took them 3-4 years to get a man. I did it after 1 year. I didn't waste my time. And we got married, and he was finishing school and finally graduated. And I started noticing there were things in our relationship that just weren't working. And I tried hard to fix it. But after about a year in our hometown, he got an offer for a job in the big town of St. Paul. Oh, I was so excited. We were going to leave this rinky-dink little town, and we were going to go to the big city, and things were going to be wonderful, and he had this wonderful job, and I was pregnant with our first child, and oh, it was just going to be wonderful. My life was going to start finally. So we moved to St. Paul, and I had the first baby, and stopped working, and things just weren't good. But we lived in one of those neighborhoods where the guys got together and drank beer and played cards. And, you know, I just, it was that neighborhood, I'm sure. I had a second baby, and things were just not good. But he got an offer for a job in Macon, Georgia. Oh, thank goodness. We were going to be out of that awful Minnesota, away from that cold, the snow, the horrible things, the, just everything. It was so awful, awful, awful. And we went to Macon, Georgia. And he had a new job, and it was just wonderful. And he was moving up the ladder in his career. And, oh, my life was going to be fine. And the children were growing up. And he went back to school to work on an advanced degree. And things just weren't right. I was noticing he was drinking. A lot. But I knew what the problem was. I really did. You know, he was working full-time, going to school. Only one of us was working. The finances were really tight. And you know, it was tough. It was really tough. So I knew what I needed to do. I went back to work, so that I could bring in some money so that he wouldn't have to worry so much. And then he wouldn't have to drink so much. We were 5 years in Macon, Georgia. and things were going downhill. Only I didn't know what was going downhill. I just didn't have a clue. But he got an offer for a job in Lafayette, Indiana. Oh, thank goodness we were going to be out of the South, you know. We were going to be back to the Midwest. We were going to be right with, you know, the type of people I thought that I'd grown up with, and life was going to be wonderful. And he wouldn't have the pressure of the job he had, and things were going to be wonderful. Anyway, this new job, he had a lot of meetings at night, and I know that, you know, you can't go to a meeting drunk, so that would be good. That job would be good for him, because it would be good for me, because he wouldn't be drinking. And we moved to Indiana. And did you know that you can drink after a meeting in the evening? And all day and night on weekends? But I still didn't know what the real problem was. Except that I started to have problems. I started to have some physical problems and didn't have a clue what was going on. At this time in my life, I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. And I had one winter. In fact, it was the last winter I was in Indiana. There was a time where there were 45 days with no sunshine. Now, I know that there's lots of scientific explanations for sunshine and moods and all, but I really went into a depression. I was able to go to work, but I came home and I sat in a chair. I couldn't cook supper. I couldn't interact with the kids. I just couldn't do anything. Wonderful news. He got an offer to move to Naples, Florida. Oh, thank you, God. I'm going to be out of this awful snow and cold and black and into the Florida sunshine. And we moved to Naples, Florida. And he was right up the ladder again in his career. And we got to Naples, Florida, and he was in a very bad place in his disease, and I was in a horrible place in mine. Only I didn't know what the problem was. I didn't know what it was. He lost his job after 5 years. And he took a job because he always went to work. Now, I want you to know that he really wasn't an alcoholic. He went to work every single day. He wore a suit and a tie. He didn't beat me. You know, he just drank too much. And all I needed to do was find a way to get him to stop. One of my things was, when we were living in Naples, I figured out that he really didn't know how much he was drinking. Now, I want you to know that the problem wasn't the beer and the wine. The problem was the bourbon. I know that you have white wine with fish and chicken and red wine with meat, and you have to have beer and pizza and beer and Mexican food. I knew that. It was the bourbon. And he was bringing home bourbon in the great big huge jugs with the handle. And he went through one of those within 2 days. And I was going crazy. Because that man did not know how much he was drinking. I mean, he had an advanced degree. He should know what he's doing, but he didn't. So my first plan was shot glasses. Now, we didn't have a set of shot glasses. And you know how he used to make his drinks? He would just take the bottle and pour. And I knew that if he measured, I mean, I know how to make a drink. You take a little shot jigger and then you fill it up with ice and mix and all that stuff. And he never did that. So I bought these wonderfully adorable little shot glasses. He never used them. My next attempt was to show him how much he was drinking. And my way to do that, I schemed long and hard for this. But because it was only the bourbon that was the problem, you understand, I decided that I would save all of the empty bottles for 1 month. And I would put them out on the table and say, this is what you drank. Now, I chose January because that has 31 days. And I got me a big old black marker. And over the label on the front, I would write January 1st, January 3rd, January 4th. I was doing really good. And I kept all these black bottles, all the bottles, the bourbon bottles, in a black plastic bag out in the garage. So he would put them in the trash, I would clean them off, write the date, and save them. That man never cleaned the garage, except January of that year. And he came into me and he said, what are you saving these liquor bottles for? And it's, oh, just nothing, just throw them away. Because, I mean, who can make a point with only half a month's liquor bottles? As I said, he had lost his big job, and he went to work at a job paying about one-third of what he had been making before. And after about a year of doing that, he got an offer to move to Stuart, Florida. And I knew things were not going to be better in Stuart, Florida. I was in such despair and such pain. He was killing himself, I knew it, and I was dying with him. And we moved to Stuart, Florida, and my mother came to live with us. She was suffering from cancer and just had a couple of months to live and spent the last couple of her months of life with us. My oldest daughter was away at college by this time, making the dean's list, very super achieving. The youngest daughter was a junior in high school with 4 F's on her report card. The family disease had affected the children in very, very different ways, but very much so. We moved to Stuart, and things were really bad. And one morning, he got up and he said, I'm going to go to the doctor today. Do you want to come? Now, he never went to the doctor, except for the trips to the emergency room because of whatever kind of problems he was having. And he'd made an appointment. And I said, really? What are you going to go to the doctor for? He says, I'm going to go and see if there's something I can do about my drinking. Wow. I about fell over. We had never discussed his drinking. Now, there were my comments like, do you really have to drink before we go to the party? We're going to have drinks at the party. You really have to drink before we go? Or, do you have to drink alone? I don't think it's good to drink alone. I think alcoholics drink alone. Or, do you need to have Bloody Marys in the morning, you know, before lunch? I think alcoholics drink before lunch. And, you know, all these wonderful questions that, you know, don't have any answer, except it's a disease. Well, he went to the doctor, and the doctor recommended, thank you, God, that the doctor he saw happened to be the staff physician at a treatment center in Stuart, Florida. And he was able to see the problems and suggested treatment for my husband, and he went to treatment. And as part of the treatment, I went to Family Week. And in Family Week, they told me I needed to go to Al-Anon. And I thought, oh, wonderful. I'll be glad to go to Al-Anon because you know what? I'm the one that's going to have to keep him sober once he gets out of the treatment center. And you know, I do need to know what to do. So I started to go to Al-Anon. And this is my anniversary month. And on the 27th of this month, a few 24 hours ago, I walked into my very first Al-Anon meeting in Stuart, Florida. And they said the Serenity Prayer, and I started to cry. I just couldn't stand the pain anymore. And I sat in those meetings and I cried just like a baby for the first 6 months. I could barely say my name. And I didn't drip quietly. I mean, I did the kind of sobbing stuff. It was so pitiful. But I started to hear the message of hope and the message of love. And we did lots of fun AA things together. In South Florida, everything in Al-Anon and AA revolves around food. You can't have a meeting or anything without food before or after or during or, you know, it was just fun. And one of my husband's sponsors said, you know, this is social sobriety. And what an interesting concept for someone who was so isolated for so long. I couldn't tell anybody what was going on at my house. I really didn't know what was going on, but I just couldn't tell anybody what was happening. After coming for a long time, I was starting to feel better, like about 6 months. I was starting to feel some peace and serenity. I was going to a meeting almost every night of the week, Al-Anon or an open AA meeting. I was reading the literature. I was doing what I heard were suggestions. But I didn't have a sponsor. For me to reach out and ask someone to help me, I couldn't do that. I wasn't good enough. What if they said no? But finally, my pain got so bad that the only thing I could do was to reach out for help. And let me tell you, God sent His absolutely best Al-Anon sponsor to me. And I started to heal. We worked step one. Now, I know I didn't have a problem with alcohol. Hey, I can take a drink. I don't even need to finish it. What's the big deal? I came to understand that I was powerless over alcohol in the bottle and in the person. The moment someone else took a drink, I was powerless. My life was unmanageable. And I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Now, I don't know if you really think that shot glasses or numbers on bottles are, you know, insane or not, but it might be a little questionable. What a terrible time, though, with step three. And I was in an open AA meeting, and the speaker was talking about step three. And he gave the illustration. There were three frogs sitting on a log. Two made a decision to jump off. How many were left? The obvious answer is three. Two of them had only made a decision. And that's what the third step asked me to do. To ask the God of my understanding to care for me. After that, I started working on my inventory. And being a little bit of an obsessive compulsive type, I wanted to do it perfect. And it took a long time, it seemed like. And I finally, I figured, you know, I've done it. My sponsor said it's time for step five. And she lived, oh, probably 5-6 miles away from me, down U.S. Highway 1, which is four-lane divided. And I was on my way up to her house for my fifth step. And there's all these really neat little places where you make U-turns on US 1, and every time I came to one, I thought, should I go back home? Should I leave? Do I have to do this? And talk about an amazing, amazing experience. We talked a lot about character defects and shortcomings and what was going on in my life. And she asked me, you know, is there any other problem? Well, I've had a problem with my mother. You know, my grandpa and my daddy, I didn't have half as much a problem with them as I did with my mother. she was always so cranky and so stern and so rigid. And what I realized, she was living with two active alcoholics. And I say, thank you, God, I only got one. And I got to hear the words come out of my mouth. I couldn't let her feel that way. And as I said the words, it dawned on me, who am I to tell someone how they should feel? I'm not God. And as I heard those words, I realized how much I had tried to control and to manipulate and to do what I wanted the world to do. In step six, I did become willing. I wanted to get rid of every single one of my shortcomings. And I didn't know how to do that. And thank you for step seven. It wasn't my job. I just needed to humbly ask God to remove my shortcomings. I am so grateful for that. In step eight, my list became quite long. Until my sponsor said, well, you have to have three columns. The first column is who you've harmed. The second column is how you have harmed them. And the third column is for step nine, and that's appropriate amends. Now, being the super responsible person that I am, I felt very responsible for everything. You know, if it was a sunny day, you know, I would love to take credit for that. And I would apologize if it rained on your picnic or your parade. And I got to understand exactly what my responsibilities were. And then to go on to step nine and make appropriate amends. And by this time, my mother had been dead for several years. And I was able to write her a letter and to share with her my life and what I remember of our life together, and to know that that relationship has really healed. In step 10, I continue to take personal inventory, and for an Al-Anon to admit when they're wrong, that takes a lot. But let me tell you, it's become a lot easier. I'm not always right anymore. I don't know what's best for you in your life. Hard to believe, but I don't. The 11th step is probably my most cherished because I start my day and end my day on my knees with my higher power. I ask God to care for me, to guide me, and to direct my steps and where He would like me to go for the day. And when I got the call to come here a year ago, I still have trust issues with God. I knew that I wouldn't say no, but I also thought, I wonder where this is going to take me. And I'm so blessed. As I was working with my sponsor after we finished working the steps, we worked the 12 traditions. And I got to understand about unity and being self-supporting and welcoming and all of the spiritual principles that are located in the traditions. And they have healed so many relationships in my life. I've been in Al-Anon, probably about 4 years or so, and my youngest daughter became active in the family disease. And she wanted to move out. And I was so grateful and so anxious to help her. She would go out on Thursday and come home on Monday or Tuesday. Or leave on Saturday and come back on Wednesday. And it was driving me crazy. And she wanted to move to a big city, and we helped with that. Now, I was going to Al-Anon, and I was her mother. And I don't know about other mothers in the room, but it's pretty hard to know that your baby is starving. And we used to go and visit and take her to the local supermarket and fill up a great big huge buggy of groceries and things that she'd need and deliver them to her little apartment. And my friends in Al-Anon just said, "She's coming back. She's coming back." Because I was enabling her as much as if I had been giving her $100 to go spend as she wanted. Because she was able to then go spend her money on what she wanted. She didn't have to worry about groceries or having her phone turned off, you know. Her mother would take care of that. That wonderful checkbook love. And I was in North Carolina at one of those wonderful, wonderful lodges up in the mountains on a vacation. There weren't even telephones in the room. That's how, you know, wonderful this place was. And had planned to spend a week there with my husband. And it was wonderful. And we got a phone call from the oldest daughter. And the youngest one, there had been all kinds of problems. She'd had sexual assault. There were police. And at this point, she had tried to commit suicide. And there is a page in our One Day at a Time book that talks about a woman who answered the door to get the bad news that her husband had been killed in the war. And she invited the pastor in who had delivered that news because she said that she learned when there was a crisis to figure out what it was she would be doing and to keep doing it. And I didn't have to run down from North Carolina to Florida to rescue my daughter, to fix it, to make it all better. I knew she was in God's hands. I knew that He was taking care of her. And He did a much, much better job than I did. As my Al-Anon time progressed, it had been about 7 years, and one afternoon, now the communication between my husband and I had gotten a whole lot better, you know. By the time the drinking ended, there was like virtually no communication at all. I told you how shocked I was when he came home and announced that he wanted to see a doctor about his drinking. But he came home one evening and he said, I want a divorce. I was devastated. I was married at 19. I'd always lived at home with my parents and married and lived 31 years with the same man. He'd been sober 7 years. He was going to meetings. I was going to meetings, and I'm so grateful for that. Because the last year he was home, I didn't have to check up on him. I knew what he did was none of my business. And my sponsor always tells me, what you need to know will be revealed to you without any effort on your part. Now, I wanted to know, before I got to Al-Anon, what everybody was doing, what everybody was saying, what everybody was thinking. But I knew, at that point, I did not know anything except right on time when I needed to. And there was another woman, and it was just, self-esteem-wise, a real blow to my ego. And he moved out, and I kept saying, I don't want a divorce. I've been married 31 years. I don't want a divorce. I don't believe in divorce. If you want a divorce, you get a divorce. Well, this went on for a long time. And finally, he moved in with the other lady, and finally, I was able to get a divorce. And I am so grateful to Al-Anon and AA friends. I am so grateful for the love and the hugs and for all that was going on for me. Because self-pity is one of those things I can get into in an instant. One morning I remember getting up, this is shortly after he left, And the cloud of self-pity was just heavy, heavy, heavy on my head. And I got into the shower, and my shower has a window in it. And the tears were coming down as heavy as the water. And I'm soaping and just standing there and sobbing, and oh, it was just, oh, poor me. And all of a sudden, I looked over at the window. And there on the glass was a tree frog with the little suction cup feet, you know? And I turned, and there was another one. And pretty soon there were three, four, five frogs, I don't know how many, had been drawn to the light. I started to laugh. God was there. God was going to take care of me. I didn't need somebody else to take care of me. I was back at step three again, asking God to care for me. And he did. I would go to the grocery store and the wave of the self-pity would come over me. And there's my favorite, one of my favorite alcoholics, right in the dairy department. We had this wonderful hug. Or to go somewhere else and bump into another friend from Al-Anon, or someone calling, or, you know, it was just so beautiful. And I knew I was going to be okay. Because in those early days, I wasn't sure. I told you how I'd always lived at home or with my husband. And I was sure that if I was alone, I would probably die. And I'd lose my job. Now, what my job has to do with a divorce, I'm not sure today. And because I lost my job, then I'd lose my house and live in a box under the interstate. I just knew all of this horrible tragedy was going to happen to me. And none of it did. None of it did. It was the fear of financial insecurity. And I got much better. And about this time, God had real plans for me. I had been active in a little bit of service in Al-Anon. My home group needed someone to do literature. Oh, that was absolutely the best job there is. Because you have to get there a little bit early. You have to put the literature out. You have to pick it up, and so you're one of the last ones to go. And my sponsor told me, now you have to read every piece of literature because you're in charge of ordering it also. And you need to know what's in it so that you'll know what to order. Wow. It just really saved my life to read all the wonderful, wonderful sharing written by other Al-Anon members. And my Friday night group, the GR had moved away. And the group was looking for a group representative. That's what Al-Anon calls their group representative. And I just knew that I couldn't do that job because, you know, I still wasn't good enough. I couldn't do that. But I could be the alternate group representative. And so I said, you know, I'd be willing to do that. And I went home and I called my sponsor and I said, well, Friday night has a new alternate group representative. And she says, and who is that? I said, and that's me. And she said, and who's the group representative? I said, oh, well, the group representative moved away, so we don't have one. And she said to me, and what does the alternate group representative do? And as the words were coming out of my mouth, the group representative takes over when the group representative isn't there. And that was my introduction into service. And it was such an exciting thing because I was with all kinds of wonderful people. And my sponsor kept telling me she needed a ride to this district meeting, and I didn't really want to go to any district meeting. But she asked, and you know, I felt a little bit of guilt, so I needed to do that for her. And so I would go by and pick her up and take her, and she had two cars in her driveway. But she got me there. We had our area elections at one point, and My sponsor always told me, you know, you need to be willing. That's all you need to do. I was always, you know, I can't do it, I can't do it. And she said, well, you just need to be willing. You know, you apply the availability and God provides the ability. Well, okay, so I'll stand. Well, anyway, we had our elections and they were looking for the alternate delegate. And there were seven people, seven of us stood up. And I thought, oh, wonderful, because after the first round of votes, you know, I'll be able to sit down and someone will get elected. And after the first round of votes, I had the most votes, so I couldn't sit down. And the next three-year term came, and they were looking for the delegate. And I knew this time, you know, that my service was over. I had just done everything now. I needed to sit down, but my sponsor once again said, you need to be willing. Just, you know, be willing. So I stood again, and I became the South Florida delegate. And what a blessing. I know someone in Al-Anon in every single state of the United States and in every province in Canada. And sometimes two and three. Because the terms overlap and not everybody is new the same year. And what a blessing to know what a worldwide fellowship this is. Today my life is wonderful because I have a higher power in my life. God gives me direction. I went to church all the time. You know, self-righteous me taking the two little girls when someone was home hungover in the bed. You know, that was my attitude. So self-righteous. And I'm so grateful today that I know God loves me and that He loves everyone too. And what a blessing again it is to be here with you this weekend, to share bits of your stories. I'm sure everybody's got some connection to one of the places I've lived. But I am so grateful for all of the love that you've shown, because I know it's through the 12 steps. The 12 steps are the key. They're the key to my recovery and to my life today. And I am so grateful, and I love you all. Thank you.